Steve Martin on radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and on ABC Victoria.
On the Conversation Hour, my co-host is Martin Hughes. He's a publisher. He has a firm press. He has quite a history of publishing in Australia. We'll talk a bit about that with Martin in just a moment. But we will talk, our first guest will be Dane Swan, retired Collingwood midfielder, star midfielder as well, 258 game players, Brownlow medalist. He's won quite a number of awards. We will talk about his new book, which is simply called My Story, and it's just being released by Hardy Grant Books. And a little bit later on this morning, we will talk photography. Naomi Cass is going to join us. She's the director of the Centre for Contemporary Photography. And there is an exhibition on that is there to be talked about. So she'll be joining us this morning as well. But as I said, Martin Hughes is my co-host for The Conversation Hour. Martin, good morning to you.
Morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Nice scarf.
Thank you very much. It got a bit nippy out there this morning, so I thought I'd better wear my scarf. It just happens to be red, white and blue.
I don't think it was that cold because I got here much earlier than you.
Oh, no, it was pretty cold.
It was pretty mild.
I had to wear the scarf this morning.
It's about 13 degrees, isn't it?
Just around the neck area. Yeah. It was needed.
Western Bulldogs, huh?
Yes. So somebody in my office said, that's enough celebrating now. And I said, it's only been a week that you're dreaming. You're going to have to put up with it for a long time. But they should be happy because everybody in the firm press office got a day off on last Monday,
right?
Because about 2 months before the finals, we decided to adopt Western Bulldogs at my company, company wide, and then as soon as we did, everything honestly turned to rubbish. We just got a lot of injuries. We started losing, and I thought I was jinxed. But then we came good, and everybody got a day off, and everyone's happy.
All right. So how long does your association with the Bulldogs go back?
Well, I've been in Australia about 20 years, and my association with the Doggies goes about 19 and a half. So I love sport. And so I knew that I would love football when I came over here to live. And so I actually went to see every Melbourne team play my first year just to get a sense of them. And I went to see the Western Bulldogs out in Princes Park, and I think they're about 10 goals up against Port Adelaide, and they managed to lose. And I thought, this is my team. They are hopeless. They need every bit of help they can get.
They need my help, yeah.
You know, I mean, to be honest with you, Collingwood would have been a better fit for me, you know, because working class, Catholic, Irish roots. But I could never go for a big popular team, a big successful team. So I always go for the underdogs. And now I'm just kind of, I'm having to recalibrate. You know, my team haven't won the flag. I'm just not used to it.
Okay. So does this mean then you are hoping that they lose badly next year?
No, I wouldn't say that. But I don't know. I mean, it's funny. Like, I think sports should be, your joy at success should be way disproportionate to how down you get with disappointment. You know, when we lose, I don't know, I'm kind of used to it. When we lose, I don't get grumpy.
Yeah.
But when we win, I go a bit nutty, as I have done in the last week and a half. In fact, I just realised this morning that I've put on 6 kilos during the finals.
6 kilos?
And I'm not a big bloke.
No.
So 6 kilos, that's a significant amount of I don't know, drinking, comfort eating. I don't know what.
Because of the stress.
It can't just be coincidental.
Mm.
But I had the best weekend last weekend. I was looking.
Because you went to the game.
I was lucky enough
to
get tickets to go to the game. I was standing up and it was just the best occasion. And then I went to the official party that night with the Dogs. And then we went out afterwards. But the highlight of my whole weekend, Steve, I've got to tell you, I was coming home about 5 o'clock. We went somewhere. We went to a place to have some drinks after the party, and at this place, which I won't mention, I managed to win $100, which was a nice crisp green $100 bill, and I got a cab or an Uber home about 5 o'clock that morning, and my driver was this Pakistani asylum seeker.
Okay.
And he had an incredible story, this guy. Like his brother had been killed in Pakistan. His family had left Pakistan, but they'd all been spread out all over the world, so he was kind of on his own. But he was out in the middle of the night driving a cab in Melbourne, and but he didn't know the grand final had been on. I'm thinking, this is astonishing.
Like, he had no idea.
He didn't know the grand final had been on. Like, And I'm saying to him, like, where are you from? Like, how come you not know? And then he goes, he told me he lived in Keilor. I said, Keilor, that's the western suburbs, but your team just won the grand final. My voice is still a bit hoarse, can you tell? So I said, your team has just won the grand final, you know, for the first time in 55 years. You've got to celebrate it. I said, seriously, if you mention Western Bulldogs, you say you're into Western Bulldogs, everyone hops in your car, they'll have a soft spot. You'll have something to talk about. That's how Australians...
That's how it works.
That's how you kind of immerse yourself in the local culture, I was saying. And so I had to actually teach him how to say Western Bulldogs, you know, and he was going, Western Bulldogs, Western Bulldogs. And so he pulled up outside my house, and then I said, all right, so you're going to support Western Bulldogs the rest of your time in Australia? And he goes, yes. I said, I'm going to give you one more incentive from the people from the Western Bulldogs. And I gave him my $100 bill, my $100 note that I'd won.
That you'd won.
And
okay.
I said, this is from the Bulldogs. You've got to support us for the rest of your time here. And the highlight of my weekend was him driving off down the street with the window open, shouting out the window, Western Bulldogs! Western Bulldogs! It was fantastic.
Pretty happy man.
Spreading the joy.
So, okay, let's just go back a small step to when you did come here and when you decided to follow AFL. Because coming from Ireland, you grew up with football, with soccer.
Yep. Gaelic football.
Gaelic
was
football,
main sport,
okay, yeah. Okay. So that was your passion when you were in
absolutely.
Ireland? So that then made the transition to Australian rules football much easier.
Not really, but
there are similarities.
Well, we were from the rival club to Jim Steins, and I actually played against his brother, so I knew a little bit about footy through the Steinses. You know, it was similar in that, like, we love football, soccer as well, but we had Gaelic football, so it was a game that was only played in Ireland. So I really appreciated that there was Australian rules football, a game that was purely exclusively Indigenous, you know, and I thought that was really something to celebrate.
Yeah. No, the reason I ask is because, as we were saying just while the news was on, I've been in Victoria for well over a decade now, getting on to 15 years, but I grew up with soccer and rugby union.
Yeah.
And of the rugby or the football codes, rugby union is the thing that I follow. And while I don't want anyone to misinterpret this, I like AFL and I enjoy watching a game occasionally, but I found it very hard to be attached to the game.
It is hard.
To have that tribalism.
I tell you, I became a member of the Western Bulldogs before I even really appreciated the game. I had to try really hard for the first several years. For the first few years, I was calling it fuzzy rules rather than Aussie rules. I couldn't believe like how grey things were, and it used to really frustrate me. But I persisted because I think because of an appreciation of the culture around the game as opposed to the game itself. Now, however, I really do love the game and I appreciate the subtleties and the complexities of it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're here because Dane Swan is our first guest.
It would have been disaster if I hadn't been here.
That's
you're not
right.
even a footy guy.
I know. Well, worried.
You're from Ballarat, so there's no reason not to get on board Western Bulldogs now.
I think, well, my son has picked Carlton as his team, so we're he's kind of on the Carlton bandwagon.
Yeah.
So I'm still just standing back, just watching things go. But we will talk with Dane Swan shortly. What I would like to ask you about, you're in publishing. You have a history with a big issue.
Yeah.
Social justice and publishing and all those things. What's the state of that industry like at the moment?
Publishing?
Yeah, publishing. Small publishing.
Small publishing is going really well.
Why?
Because I think we're kind of, small publishers are more nimble and agile. The bigger publishers who have always enjoyed something of a monopoly because they have the economies of scale, they're actually struggling with the new kind of landscape. Whereas the smaller publishers are all growing much faster than the market, and certainly much faster than the big publishers. And I think because we have a kind of we're nimble, we're agile, we can because of also third-party distribution these days, it means that we've got the reach of the big publishers, but we've also got the intimacy and the passion of the small publishers. In fact, the best way to measure the success of small publishers these days, I think, is the fact that the big publishers are trying to kind of devolve into little units that mimic the shape of small publishers. So we've always been really optimistic, you know. It was a bad few years for book publishing. But we decided that we weren't going to be pessimistic and talk down the industry like a lot of other people were. We thought, look, we're going to be optimistic. We're going to try our best. If it fails, then we'll be miserable. But until then, we're just going to talk it up and celebrate the good things rather than complain about the bad ones.
And part of the reason I ask about if things are good and how it's going is because lately it seems there's less talk about everything becoming digital.
Yeah.
There is more talk about tangible analog versions of publications. So
a few years ago, like when ebooks came online, a lot of people were saying that it's going to be a tidal wave.
Yeah.
And you know, that would have been good for small publishers because that would have removed the economies of scale required in printing, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that's a bit boring. And that's kind of plateaued at about 10-15% of the market. And there doesn't seem to be... So paper books are still holding their own. You know, we're very lucky in Australia. We've got fantastic independent book retailers. And it's really exciting in Melbourne alone. Like, there's two new independent books opened over the last couple of weeks in Richmond and a kid's store in Readings in Carlton. And so that just shows you that the industry is going well. And it's on the back of those passionate independent retailers.
Yeah. Martin Hughes is my co-host. He is a publisher with Affirm Press. Our first guest on the Conversation Hour this morning is a champion footballer. He's just retired and he's just released his book. The book is simply called My Story. Dane Swan is the author. He's retired from Collingwood. He played 258 games, I think is the figure. Brownlow medalist, triple Copeland medal winner, Anzac medalist as well. And he's with us in the studio this morning. Dane, good morning to you.
Morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for coming in to talk about the Western Bulldogs. So what did you think of that last weekend?
Yeah, no, it was brilliant, wasn't it? It was all right, I guess, like every other person in Melbourne. If your team didn't win it, I guess everyone wanted the Bulldogs to win it. So it's nice, but the love affair's probably done now, I think. I think we've just loved the Bulldogs to death.
Yeah,
so it's probably,
I agree. You know, I mean, like, as everyone kind of loves to hate Collingwood.
Yeah.
We've been the opposite end of that spectrum.
Exactly.
You know, people have been kind of a bit patronising because nobody fears us, but hopefully that will change now. I have to say, I've been wondering after reading your book how many of the Western Bulldogs players smuggled mates into the MCG in the boot of their car.
Yeah.
Do you know of any?
No, you can't do it anymore.
Oh, really? Because of you?
Because of the security risks or something, they check your boot these days.
Right.
So they would have got quite a shock on grand final day 6 years ago. Two mates had been sitting in the boot and they popped it. But that was interesting.
So in 2010, when you smuggled two mates in, what time did you have to get into the ground?
So the game starts at 2:40, 12:40.
Okay, so there's heaps of people already in there. So they just kind of scrambled and went to standing area.
I said, boys, you haven't got tickets. This is as far as I can get you. Good luck. get up an elevator or do what you can, but that's it for me.
And without naming names, did any of your teammates do that?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, so the official attendance figures need to be revised.
Revised by about 8. I got the idea from one of my mates. I was like, okay, from one of the boys. So yeah, I was like, yep, colored mates want to come, they can jump in the boot.
Well, congratulations on 2010 and a stellar career. It's been amazing. The one figure that Steve didn't mention that I think is most impressive is the fact that you played all Australian 5 years in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty incredible, like, to have that consistency at that top level.
Yeah, I think, you know, the one thing I did try and pride myself on was my consistency. I tried to make, you know, my bad games, the level between my good and bad games as small as possible. So... I think my consistency was the thing that I stood for throughout my career, so it's probably something I'm most proud of.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a terrific effort. Like I was saying to you, everybody loves to hate Collingwood, but I can tell you, amongst my mates, that everyone had a begrudging respect for you, and not even respect, there was a fondness too, because people would be thinking, yeah, he's Collingwood, but God, I wish he was on our team.
Yeah, thank you. You know, hopefully people liked the way I went about it. I guess I sort of did it a little bit differently, but I just tried to enjoy myself and have some fun along the way. No point playing the sport you love if you can't enjoy it and have some fun along the way. So hopefully people from all clubs seen that. And that was me. I wasn't trying to put it on. I wasn't trying to be fake. That was exactly who I was throughout my career. And sometimes it got me into trouble, which I'm sure people from other clubs like, but
exactly, yeah. So sometimes when you're at odds with the Collingwood establishment, then all of the other fans would then go, "Yes, Sonny, go."
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so you had you had several kind of indiscretions or misdemeanors. The only one that I found unforgivable was the one that Mick Malthouse didn't rub you out for.
Yeah,
you know, because that's why we get outraged. You know, God, he's been drinking 6 days before a match. Ban him, you know.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it must be a unique, incredible situation to be in with the biggest club in town, and you're the kind of pantomime villain, you know, because you've got the tats and because you don't toe the line and stuff. I mean, it's no wonder the Herald Sun are so interested in you.
I've kept them in business over the last 10 years. Don't worry about that. Anything to do with me sells them lots of papers, and the good is they make the good a lot better and they make the bad a lot worse. So, but that's what they are. They're a gossip mag, aren't they? So that's how they sell papers. So it is what it is. But, I've had my fair share of run-ins with them and with the media. But
Will you be glad to be shut of all that after this publicity tour for the book?
Absolutely, mate. I can't sit here and say I don't think I'll ever be into papers again, because I can't sit here and promise that, because I probably will. But for, 90% of my life now, hopefully, is forgotten about, and I can go on with other things.
How difficult is it being in that public eye 24/7 during the season? I just wonder what it's actually like, knowing that you are being watched and then your everything you do is picked apart.
Yeah, it got a lot harder. You know, there's this wonderful thing called social media, which, you know, it's obviously like a double-edged sword. You can use it for great things, or, you know, it can be pretty ordinary against you the other way. So, and clearly that is becoming a bigger and bigger thing in society. So, even more so now, people with camera phones and things like that can take pics, and someone has to write one thing on Twitter, and someone in the media or something just sees it and all retweets,
off
and then all of a sudden it's real, whether, you know, it's happened or not. So, I guess I learned to embrace it a little bit. The more I found you bit back, the worse it got.
Yeah.
So I just tried to laugh at it, and just all the bad things that people wrote about me on such, I just liked them. I just liked the tweet a lot, posts, and just let people know that I've seen it and I liked it and I don't really care. Yeah. You're not going to get under my skin. So
Could you see over the life of your career at the top level that as it intensified, that social media
enormous
criticism
amount.
From when you started, not much, to by the time you finish, everywhere?
1,000%. It's, when I first started, my first year was 2002. There was, I don't even know when the iPhone was invented, but I certainly don't think it was 2002.
Mm.
But you could get away with, you know, absolutely anything. You know, things that, you know, the going out and sort of doing what you wanted in my first couple of years was easy, because, and I guess the other thing was that no one knew who I was either, so it made it a lot easier. But, mate, now, or in the last few years, mate, you can't go out for dinner without, and people think we're stupid. You can actually see when people are like holding up a phone, trying to take a photo, and I was like, well, I'm not an idiot. I can see you pointing the phone at me and trying to, like, you know, pretend to write a message, and you can see it. So it's gone up, you know, so much. It's not funny. It's only going to get worse. So I feel sorry for the kids that are coming in who are gonna have that sort of personality and go out and, you know, want to enjoy themselves, because they're going to get hammered in the media. They're getting hammered on social media. But, you know, if you want to play the game of AFL, you have to deal with it. You know, someone said one day you get paid 10% to play footy and 90% for the rest of the garbage that comes with it. And I guess that's understandable. I don't, just because I didn't like it doesn't mean I don't understand it. How, you know, it's a $1 billion industry, football, and it pretty much makes Melbourne go around for 6 months of the year. So,
but I mean, you've got a really good attitude about it. You know, like you say that football set you up. How old are you now? 31?
32.
You're set up. You've probably got a bit of cash behind you. You're still very young, certainly in terms of Steve and I, and you got your life ahead of you. But it's kind of unrealistic to expect 17, 8-year-olds to put their lives on hold, to stop being teenagers, even when the rewards for being a professional footballer are so good. You know, do you think you were maybe drafting kids too young? Were you drafted too young?
Oh no, my dad says it was. I said I was too young. I was too immature. I drafted at 17, straight out of school. Never had a decent job. Mm. My first contract was $36,000. I think I made. Moved straight out home. Moved straight in with a mate, and spent every cent I had as soon as I got. I was doing what my 18-year-old mates were doing, who were tradies.
Yeah.
You know. So, and I had no idea about life and concept of hard work or work ethic or life in general. I was just having fun and being a kid. And you know, thankfully, if I had done what I was doing back then, now I would have been sacked in 3 months. They would have paid me out and said, "See you later, mate. You're not cut out to be an AFL forward." But thankfully, I got drafted at a time where it was still culturally all right to sort of have a beer and relax and let your hair down. And there wasn't welfare managers. There wasn't, obviously, the big thing was social media, and the media wasn't as big on it. So you get away with a lot more. So I was a bit lucky. So I got a couple of years to sort of get set straight, where these kids these days, they get straight put straight in. And, you know, even you look, you know, a kid gets drafted on draft day, and they all scan straight through their Twitter, straight through their Instagram, and they find a tweet they did 2 years ago, like that kid from Carlton a couple of years ago, where he got drafted to Carlton, and then they found a tweet 2 years before bagging the Blues or saying the Blues are no good, or Mick should be given the sack. And he's a 16-year-old kid that's written it because he's a young kid who loves footy and he's venting, and he gets drafted on draft day, and everyone just scans back through everything they've done, looks through all their Facebook, looks for a photo to put them on the front page to embarrass them or to give them a clip, and that's completely not fair.
It's incredible pressure. Like, I'm surprised more people don't really kind of snap and need to have more negative effect on the players. Maybe the clubs are responding and being more focused on the welfare side of things.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, as long as nobody takes it all too seriously. Mm. I think we do tend to take it a bit too seriously, football, sport in general in Australia. I was just saying to Steve before you came in, I mean, for me, sport is always about being disproportionately celebrate the wins, but don't get too disappointed about the downs. You know, it's only a game.
Exactly. You can't win all the time, otherwise it wouldn't be a sport.
Yeah.
You got to take the ups and downs, because that's what makes sport so great. Well, the Bulldogs up this year, and then...
I've gone way over the top.
Well, and so you should. It's been 60-odd years.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You have every right to, and I'm sure, and I certainly hope the Bulldogs players have gone way over the top too, because they deserve it. And then next year it'll be someone else. It'll be another great story.
I was amazed over the weekend how much the expectations on the Doggies players for all the... after winning the flag, they couldn't really get a chance to celebrate for several days. They had so many functions to attend. You know, they really are expected to keep a lid on it and almost be like robots, you know. I mean, they're 20 somethings. I was going mental, and I was just one of the fans. I hadn't worked 100 as hard as them on you know, and they couldn't get to celebrate it for several days.
Yeah, I wouldn't have shown up to half the functions if I was at the Bulldogs.
That's
so.
You, yeah,
yeah.
But I mean,
you probably would have got away with it as well.
Oh well. Hopefully, yeah. I was copped a fine and just dealt with it, and whatever. Yeah. Fun.
Let me ask you, Dane. Your retirement came earlier this year, forced on you.
Yeah.
Did you expect to retire at the end of this year anyway? Were you thinking about it?
I was certainly thinking about it. I just think once you get to sort of 30, I can't understand how people at 30 AFL footballers aren't start thinking about retirement. You can't have your head in the sand and think you're going to play unless you're Boomer Harvey or Fletcher and think you're going to play till 40. If you're not putting plans in place when you're 29, 30 to retire, well, you're going to get to it whenever you retire 32 and go, what am I going to do now? Yeah. I've got nothing to do. Mm. So, you know, I just looked at my career was going to end at the end of each contract. And if I was lucky enough to get another one, well, I'd go from there, because the game changes so quickly. I don't understand how you can just think, yeah, I'll play. I'm going to get another contract. I'm going to do what I like. It's my foot. So thankfully I had things in place. But, that was... would have depended on how I went this year and how the side went where we would have finished up this year. But because of my foot, I wanted to go on. I was like, I don't want to end not touching the footy in my final ever game. Well, I touched it and I dropped the mark. That's what it probably cost me. But I would have liked to have gone on. But, you know, as much as I love game day and love the game of football, I wasn't going to sacrifice the rest of my life for playing another game.
Explain what happened to your foot. Just the damage that was done to it, because it's incredible.
I ruptured the Lisfranc ligament that I broke.
That holds everything together.
Yeah, so that's... Yeah. Well, when I broke the 3, 4, 5 metatarsal and I broke my fibula, when I actually heard it in the down the rooms in Sydney, I noticed when I was walking off, I could feel the bone moving. I feel the hole in my leg where I broke my leg. So, you know, the doc, that was easily diagnosable. So I sort of copped that. And then my foot started to blow up, sort of look like a hammerhead shark, like on both sides of my foot, started to get golf balls. I was like, that's not right. And the dog was like, the bones don't matter. There's this one ligament in there called the Lanfranc ligament. That's the thing you don't want to hurt, because that's pretty much holds all your foot together. And obviously I don't do things in halves. So I ruptured that and sort of, yeah, that was, you know, a pretty ordinary way to finish my career.
It was unfortunate. So you've retired from football now. What's the physical toll on your body, not just the foot?
Yeah, so I've obviously got my foot, which is looking good.
It's not, listeners, I can tell you.
I had both hips. I had surgery on both hips the last 2 years.
Your wrists?
My wrists don't bend anymore. So that's as far as they bend.
Which is not very far for listeners.
Pretty much straight. I can't play video games. I can't play games anymore because my wrists don't bend over the controls.
Can you grab a stubby?
That is one thing I can do. I've taught myself to drink again. Yes, absolutely.
Do you drink it a bit though, like a Thunderbird?
Yeah, get one go at it, so it goes down. I can't do push-ups anymore, which is great for me.
Yeah,
which is great. The last couple of years, every time we do push-ups, the club's like, I can't do them. So that was good. And then just your general aches and pains, but I've been reasonably lucky, I guess. I'm going to have arthritis in my wrist. They said my foot might have to get fused, and I'm going to have arthritis in that, obviously, before I should. And I had the two hip scopes to prevent arthritis coming earlier than what it should. So
that was quite a toll all over, not just the foot.
Yeah, so but...
Do you still keep fit now? I mean, it sounded like if I had any one of those injuries, I would be barely leaving the couch. But do you still keep fit? Because I imagine it would be very difficult for someone who's an elite athlete with those endorphins and get used to it for the mental kind of health issue. How do you cope without...
Yeah, well, because it's my retirement party. I haven't done a heap this year. I haven't ran since before the Sydney game, like outside. So that's when round one, late March or something like that. So I haven't ran outside since then because I can't.
But you're coping okay with that mentally?
Yeah. I think there's going to get to a point where I need to do something.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I had the pins and screws taken out of my foot a couple of weeks ago. And the day before that, I went to the club and got on the rower and just had a sweat because I was like, And I thought I was a bloke who would probably sack fitness, and I'm pretty lazy. I was like, oh, I can't wait to get out of here. But, you know, obviously my retirement party had quite a few beers over quite a number of days, so I was like, I think I just need to go and have a sweat. So I think I will stay – I'll definitely stay active. There's no chance I will stay as active as what a professional athlete needs to be, because my body's past that, and it's going to be nice to be able to just go for a run, jog, and stop when I want. And I feel a bit tight, I'm going for a walk and then start up the jog when I feel like it again, not being yelled at by fitness coaches to run through to the cone. But I think my partner would probably want me to stay in decent shape too.
Yeah,
so.
Well, you look all right, you know, except for you're still wearing black and white, which is unfortunate. I wanted to say, like, I really enjoyed your book. I mean, it wasn't the scandal and the controversy that people might assume from the cartoon villain of the biggest club in the country, but... it was very warm, and like you're very humble, and you didn't shy away from the indiscretions and what happened to them. And I think one of the things that I'd like to listeners to know about your record is the fact that last game where you got one touch and it finished your career. If that game hadn't have counted in your official stats, you would retired as the leading average of possession getter in the history of the game.
That's great. Well, can we scratch that game from the record?
I think we should.
I was on the ground for 45 seconds.
You should start a petition.
I might. Absolutely.
Everyone who comes into the Albion, if it ever actually opens, you get them to sign a petition.
Yeah. Well, I'll certainly be there, mate. Don't worry about that. I'll be there long enough.
The book is My Story, Dane Swan's book. It's released today from Hardy Grant Books, and Dane Swan has been our first guest on The Conversation Hour this morning. Dane, last question from me.
Yep.
Given what you've just said about the body, what's happened to it, the career you've had, the games you've played, was it worth it?
Yeah, absolutely.
No regrets.
No, and no regrets from anything, from all the indiscretions or anything. I don't. Everything I've done up to this point has made me the person I am, and you know, I've got some amazing friends and family around me, and the people I've met through my career. You know, we're going to be mates for life. We've got a bond for life. So, absolutely no regrets at all. So, I'm very privileged to have played, you know, a game that I would have played for free. Whether I was good enough to play in front of 100,000 on grand final day at AFL, or I was playing it, you know, fourth division, you know, out of where the worst league in Melbourne. I've been doing it for free. I was just very, very fortunate that I was lucky enough to sort of make a career out of it and sort of get my life started on the right track.
Right. Dane Swan is our guest. Our next guest is Naomi Cass, who is the director of the Centre for Contemporary Photography, and she's the curator of, now you can correct me, Naomi, if I get this wrong, the documentary Take, Walker Evans and Selected Australian Art. Is that
pretty
right?
Close.
Pretty
and
close.
And the world is a picture. The world is being pictured. We have two shows. One is Walker Evans, the magazine work, curated by a very important international curator, looking at the magazine work. Mm-hmm. He's well known for these images, but not many people understand or know these images were born in his magazines. Images that you may not know were by Walker Evans, but photos of workers, photos of people on the subway, candid photos, people who weren't aware that they were being photographed. And alongside that show, we have the documentary Take, which is looking at contemporary artists and how documentary photography is seeping into their practice because artists want to talk about the world.
Mm. It does tie in to our other guests, and because Martin, you've been involved in publishing and magazine publishing for many years, so the photography there. Dane, I reckon you've been photographed how many times? Have you ever tried to count?
Yeah, that I'm aware of, or obviously been photographed quite a bit. Not something I'm super comfortable with standing in front of the camera, but.
It's a very handsome shot on the front of your book.
Yeah. It looks a bit tough.
Yeah, I don't know where that's come from.
In real life, maybe you were a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah,
like that.
It's what airbrushing and playing around on Photoshop does, aren't it? With photos. They can do wonderful things.
But that's the interesting thing. People have been playing with the photo since they were first made. One assumes a gritty black and white photograph is the truth, it's reality, but once the negative is being printed in the darkroom, there's plenty of evidence that photographs are
really
manipulated.
But I mean, that's one of the things about Walker Evans that you think that was all really... Like, with Walker Evans, I did a quick search before mm-hmm. the show, and I was surprised how many images I recognised that didn't
yes.
know were his.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they're the most authentic images, surely, in kind of mainstream culture. Like that they weren't set up or there was minimal setup, I would have thought. Minimal kind of Photoshop, etc.
Well, he was playing with the images.
Yeah.
I mean, he's out there with a camera. He had a camera under his overcoat and he was photographing on subway. I don't think people would have been that aware that they were being photographed. Occasionally you can see someone looking down into the camera lens.
Yeah.
His playing with the images was done post the photograph in the choices he was making and how he laid them out, which works he was selecting, and also framing. The photographer has a lot of power in how they cut the image down, what they put it next to, and the text. So he was working with James Agee
mm-hmm.
for Fortune magazine. So two skills that important to you in your work and important in football is the commentary as well as the image. They live together.
Speaking of football, which is your team?
Yes. Well, now I might be the first person you three gentlemen have ever met who has never been to a football match.
What? You're not from Melbourne,
don't turn
obviously.
The radio off, please. Yes. And how many art galleries have you been in, sir?
Dozens.
Yeah. I was at the Mona 2 weeks ago in Tasmania. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's that's an interesting place, that one. So there's my art for you.
Good.
There's my art gallery. Yeah, I've seen the Dali exhibition when I was here.
Well, that's a lot more football than I've attended. So,
yeah, so there's two
I
for
take
you.
My hat off.
And Tim Burton exhibition.
Is Swanee the first footballer you've met? Because I'm hoping this won't end up with you being converted to a Collingwood fan.
Well, the hair's doing a little bit of black and white for me.
I mean, the timing and all, the Western Bulldogs coming first in 55 first. Years, etc. So if you were going to have a soft spot for a team, I think it must have been the Dogs.
Maybe a bit of a dog overkill.
Already dog overkill? No way.
Internet is very good because my poor husband does follow the football, but it's very subterranean. Never am I in the room when that's occurring.
Yeah.
Who's your husband for?
Sorry?
Who's your husband for?
Can't say. Ooh. Actually, I don't know.
Must be Carlton.
it would be Carlton.
No, I think his team was drummed out of Melbourne a few years ago.
So the whole culture of photography has changed so much. Like Swanee was talking earlier on about social media, which has coincided with the onslaught of the digital age. How has that affected photography in the context of art?
Oh, that's really interesting. One of the artists we're showing made a beautiful comment to me, if I may share with you, that because of the high-quality recording devices that everyone or most people have on them, the studio is now the whole world. The studio is in the street. So in a sense, I mean, artists have had a pencil and a drawing block in their pocket for a long time and, you know, there are beautiful sketches done on the roadside. But because you can record sound and image, in a sense, the artist is always at work.
Yeah.
The studio is much expanded. And that brings to mind a work we've got in the show by Ponch Hawkes, who's well known for her work in theatre. She, being a great sports fan, went down to the Melbourne Marathon in 1982, and she photographed the women as they crossed the finishing line. This is 2 years before women were allowed to run in the marathon in the Olympics. So she's there being witness to the participation of women, their most beautiful photographs.
The pioneers.
And a young girl looking cool as a cucumber, 10, had just finished the marathon. So there we are.
So they weren't officially allowed to enter, but these women just went, oh, stop.
They
that.
Were allowed to enter the Melbourne's way ahead.
Yeah.
We know that. They're allowed to enter the marathon here.
Yeah.
And that was the second year of the marathon, but 2 years before women were permitted in the Olympic Games.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Mm. Can I just ask, when we talk about, you talk about some of this photography and these photographs that are there from Walker Evans as well, and the new digital photography, are we going to lose some aspect of what we're taking photographs of now because of the digital nature of things? People will just wipe it, or we won't have the ability to read that file format.
Yeah.
Because the Walker Evans photographs, they're hard copies. They're there forever, and it's just a matter of reproducing them. I wonder if you have any fears for history at some point in the future. We won't be able to get to some of the photos we're taking.
Well, ironically, in a way, the digital has made a place like Centre for Contemporary Photography more important because photography is ubiquitous, it's everywhere, but the sense of a critical look at photography becomes really important, as does the maintenance of our archive. And Walker Evans's museum works might have faded and lost their definition, but his magazine work is still there in the magazines, and we're showing big digital copies of his magazine work. But, you know, for all the young people who are using photography in a very different way, drop their phone down the toilet, it's gone, the images. Mm. And it's a big issue for museums, how they migrate the technology.
Yeah. I mean, if it's one file format, if it's on floppy disk, originally
print
was saved
it.
on
print it. Print your photos, everyone.
But
rush out.
But if some of it is saved on one format and then all of a sudden, like floppy disk, nobody has that anymore.
Mm.
Well, pretty much. So it's gone. You know where it is. You can see it and hold it in your hand, but you can't look at the photograph anymore. So I just wonder with some of the digital technology if there are concerns.
Unless you're a celebrity like Swanee, where other people keep all your photographs for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even when you don't want them to. Mm.
Do you, with your publishing, do you keep your photographs separately in file, or do you print them off and have them as analog versions, as an actual printed photo?
We would do both if they're original photographs. Mm. Yeah.
To make sure that you have a good quality copy,
yeah,
as well as the digitally stored one.
Yeah, yeah, and we have to have systems set up because I'm not the most organized. So if it was left to me, they'd just be gone. So we have systems where everything's recorded and kept permanent.
The Walker Evans photographs in the exhibition are from what period predominantly? What era?
These are his magazine work, so work for Fortune magazine and a number of other publications and books. We have the original journals, which is very exciting. We have them in multiple editions. And I listened to you speaking earlier about the resurgence or the sort of the fantasy that the paper book was going to disappear. Mm-hmm. There is a resurgence in photography publication in photo books. It's really
absolutely
massive. It's very exciting. Well, and this show is important for people to begin to think about the page as a critical visual space and the relationship of text to the image, to the font. Walker Evans determined all of that. There he was working for Fortune magazine, you know, a laudable right-wing publication, and he was given absolute carte blanche to develop his own series. So he was looking at workers. He was looking at discarded aspects of society.
They are stunning photographs, some of his photos that I've managed to sort of see and have a look. They're really quite beautiful.
They are, absolutely. Often because there's this marvellous look on someone's face who isn't aware that they're being photographed.
Mm. Yeah, just knew the right time. He had that eye to just take the photo at the right time. And again, the technology that we have now, I think, is wonderful. I was talking with someone who was photographing the other day, and I thought, well, the technology is wonderful. The skill set maybe is not surviving, because they were talking about just shooting off 30, 40 frames to get that one good shot. In the old days of film, the photographer, the skill was in actually knowing when to take the shot.
It's still one has to have a good eye. Mm. In a sense, we're told it's faster, quicker, bigger, brighter. But in fact, every artist, whether they're a photojournalist or someone showing in a museum, it's a blank page, you know, and the artist has to use all their skill to get our attention.
Naomi, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
For having a bit of a chat and explaining a bit more about the Walker Evans exhibition and the documentary Take that is on at the Centre for Contemporary Photography. Dane, thanks for coming in as well.
No worries.
And talking through your career and the book. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
It's a good read and you know, a lot of effort putting in for those sort of things. So,
cheers.
Lovely to have you in. And also, Martin, thank you for your time.
Thanks,
this
dude.
Morning.
Pleasure.
How much longer are you going to wear that scarf for?
Well, until it gets to about 35 degrees, I'd say.
All right. Well, probably not that. Yeah, it could be a while. You're going to be wearing it for some time. Thanks for your help today with the Conversation Hour.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.